All right. Good morning again. The court calls United States v. Moss. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, I'm Captain Ian Guy, and along with Colonel Kevin Boyle, we represent the appellant, Private First Class Amanda Moss. POC Moss was denied her Sixth Amendment rights to the effective assistance of counsel and conflict-free counsel when her defense counsel read an unsworn statement without her authorization and then failed to ask the military judge to remove any prejudice that stemmed from it.
Counsel, before you get into your substantive argument, I have a procedural issue that hopefully you can clear up for us. The record contains the standard post-trial rights letter that the appellant gets after trial, and that form authorizes clemency material and appeal to the CCA. Following the CCA decision, a letter was sent to the accused asking whether or not she wanted to appeal to this court. That letter was returned undeliverable and unopened. We can't find anything in the record where your client authorizes this appeal. And if that's the case, then I think you obviously have an issue very close to the issue that you're arguing. That, you know, can we proceed without authorization of the client to complete this appeal? Is there something that we don't know that isn't in the record as to her authorization for this appeal?
Your Honor, there, under this court's holding in U.S. v. Schreck in 1980, the appellate defense counsel is able to make a petition on behalf of the absent client.
But the letter that was sent from the CCA to the client specifically stated that you need to notify whether or not you would like us to appeal, or whether or not you would like an appeal to be brought on your behalf. And it seems to me that that has some import or influence here. And without that, and particularly with the form, the post-trial form limiting the appellate defense counsel to submit clemency material and to represent the individual before the CCA, it's also clear in that form that the client may choose to appeal to this court if the CCA affirms the sentence. And so with all of that set up, I'm just wondering whether or not it's implied that the defense attorney can just make a decision on their own to authorize an appeal on behalf of a client that they haven't consulted.
Well, yes, it is implied because the duty to represent continues on to this court.
Well, what statutory or rule-based authority do you have to do what you've done?
The primary rules for professional conduct as lawyers to continue advocating on behalf of the client in the same matter.
Do we know whether or not Moss is in favor of this appeal or would not like to have the appeal continue? I mean, is there any evidence anywhere in the record as to her personal views as to the appeal?
She indicated that she wanted representation at ACCA, and that would imply that everything that is in the record that could raise a viable issue would mean that she would be in favor of that.
Okay, thank you. I think I understand your position.
Does the Army know where she is?
I do not know if the Army knows where she is.
Okay, but obviously the Army knew when it was asking her whether she wanted representation at the CCA level. You just said she indicated she wanted representation at the CCA.
She filled out the post-trial appellate rights.
Okay, so the Army obviously knew where she was then.
The Army knew where she was then.
Did she fill out that form at the time of the appeal, or did she fill it out at the time that her trial ended as part of the wrap-up with the defense counsel?
It was prior to the trial, Your Honor, and it was
So before she went deserted again?
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh, it was filled out before she disappeared?
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh. So, and that was how many years ago?
2 plus years, Your Honor.
Counsel, can we proceed on the assumption, absent anything else in the record, that all parties have, in this case, followed their ethical responsibilities, including responsibility to make an effort to contact the client, and that in the absence of the record, that the parties are proceeding on the basis that the client cannot be contacted. I'm not asking any of you to testify. I'm asking whether this court can proceed on that assumption, a presumption of regularity in this case.
I believe that the court can proceed with the assumption that counsel have followed ethical duties. Now, I would note that the government has not moved for the petition to be dismissed. When the petition was filed back in March, the government did not file a motion for the petition to be dismissed on any grounds.
Well, you don't disagree that if we find that we can't proceed without the accused permission, that we can dismiss it as improvidently granted, do you?
U.S. v. Smith from the CMA back in the 70s.
Counsel, first let me ask, is the court asking for additional briefing on this issue?
I think that would be helpful, and it would involve...
In any event, the government should have the opportunity to respond to this matter, which was not part of the granted issue, and in fairness to you, how much time would you need to respond, and not the government, the appellant, how much time would you need to respond to this, and then how much time would the government need to respond to your response? Is a week soon enough? How about a day?
A week is reasonable.
We'll negotiate. A day or a week? You took a week. Okay.
I'll take a week, yes.
Okay, is that agreeable with everybody up here?
Yeah.
And how much time would you need to respond? Everybody agreeable to that?
And I would.
Wait one second. What would you like to say?
My question is, if it's the will of the court to obtain that briefing, then I think we have to consider at the same time whether there should be any further argument at this point. Absent, if that's considered to be a significant question, then I think there's a question whether there should be any continued argument at that point until that is resolved. I may or may not regard that as a significant question, but I respect my colleagues in that regard.
First of all, it's my view that the government should certainly have, the appellant should certainly have an opportunity to respond to the question that's been raised. It'd be my inclination to proceed with oral argument on the presumption of regularity that you suggested. And I think that if both parties are prepared to do that, then I would be prepared to do that. Is there any objection to so doing?
I think that probably.
Is there any objection? Is there any objection from the government? Is there any objection from the appellant? Okay. Yeah. So, to make the record clear, the appellant will have 1 week from today to respond to the question presented. The government will then have 1 week to respond to the response. We will proceed with the oral argument on the issue granted today, operating on a understanding of presumption of regularity until such presumption is or is not rebutted. Is that fair? Everybody in agreement with that?
Yes, Your Honor. And we're just
okay. And we will give you additional time at this time of some unknown amount, basically until such time as you're just talking. You were going to say something. What were you going to say?
I was just going to ask if it would be possible for the clerk's office to render the specified question into writing so that we have that for our proper guidance.
What we will do is we will take the oral argument today, the tape, and he will ask the clerk to take Judge Erdman's question so that it's clear and both parties will be provided the statement of the question.
And if both parties could address at least partially whether or not the decision as to a right to appeal to this court is a personal decision of an accused.
And, of course, if you need more time to respond, having looked at the growing list of questions, you can request time, and we will either grant it or we will not.
Well, I'd like that question to incorporate the concept that if an appellant cannot be located, what the responsibilities are of counsel under those circumstances.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
You will get a written question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. How much time do you need to make your argument today?
If I could have another 8 minutes.
You bet. Is that something you can do right now, or? Okay, there you go. Wow, that's interesting. Okay.
I would like to begin with the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, beginning with the deficient performance prong. Defense counsel was deficient for four reasons. Defense counsel did not know the law when he made the unsworn statement, therefore it was not a tactical decision made in accordance with the law. Further, the military judge found that the statement was made in error. And three, the defense counsel admits that he did not have the permission of POC Moss to make the statement. And four, it was unreasonable for the defense counsel to make statements of fact that were so easily rebutted. Regarding the prejudice problem, prior to the unsworn statement, there was no reason for the government to present any evidence regarding POC Moss's character for truthfulness. It was only after the defense counsel opened the door by mentioning the name Viola Mitchell and referenced her as a sick aunt that it opened the door for the government to bring in rebuttal. Second point, defense counsel undercut his already strong sentencing case when he presented the statements of fact.
What should we make of the fact that the judge said it was entirely his fault that the statement was admitted, and therefore, does that or does that not make the defense counsel's decision not to ask for a remedy at that point the fulcrum of IAC rather than the statement itself? Question, not statement.
Yes, Your Honor. At the point where the defense counsel failed to request the remedy, that is IAC, and it's also the conflict of counsel. Because at that point, that's when the conflict exists. Either defense counsel alleges that he was IAC and helps his client and makes an argument to help his client, or else he does nothing, he sits on it. At that point,
was there IAC before this point in the view of appellant?
In the view of appellant, yes, because even the unsworn statement upon its own had carried prejudice. It was deficient under Markham to make the unsworn statement as a military judge. It was error. And then the fact that the government was able
even
to
if the judge took it upon himself to say my fault.
Certainly, the court can look at it that way. It was the military judge. He was given the heads up that defense counsel was going to make the unsworn statement, and he said it's your prerogative to do so. He misapprehended the law. He allowed it. He took ownership of it. At the 39A session during deliberations. Defense counsel still had to know the law, too, and so it's either ineffective assistance counsel or it's on the judge. If it's on the judge, it is a lesser standard on the prejudice, but the prejudice is the same. It's that the statement opened the door for the defense or for the government to stand up and offer rebuttal using a defense witness.
So on prejudice, how do you deal with the fact that this is a three-year UA with a missed deployment to a combat zone. The government, the exposure is 1 year. The government asked for 9 months, and the appellant ends up with 6 months, and the CCA is reviewing this. And where does one get the sense that this impacted the outcome? And then, of course, you have the defense counsel himself in the affidavit saying he thinks it was very effective because it actually led to a lesser sentence.
A few points, Your Honor. We know that the panel did consider this because when Sergeant First Class David Wallace was on the stand, panel members asked two questions to follow up and get clarification about Viola Mitchell. First, they asked who raised POC Moss. He answered, my mother, or her mother and me. Second question was, well, what's the relationship with PFC Moss and Viola Mitchell? He said, I do not know who Viola Mitchell is. That was a panel member's question. The panel then was never instructed not to consider this or how they can consider it, whether they can consider it as mendacity, only going to rehabilitate potential, or if it could be used for any other purpose. And the government then argued, made it one of the primary points, initially saying she made up a story. And essentially the child counsel said she's a liar about why she was missing.
And the government asked for 9 months, and they were so persuasive they got six. So how does that show prejudice?
The sentence could have been lower, Your Honor. The sentence could have been lower, and it's unreasonable to believe that the panel bought any of the mitigation that was presumed, or that defense counsel said was offered in the statement.
Well, they bought something. A wartime desertion, terminated by apprehension, and she gets 6 months?
Well, the defense counsel did put on a strong sentencing case with four witnesses, three fellow soldiers, two NCOs that said that they would deploy with her, and that she had rehabilitative potential. But one of the government witnesses, even, it was ineffective for the government. In fact, he should have been a defense witness by saying that she has rehabilitative potential. All of that was strong. Now, once the unsworn statement is fully rebutted, to make it look like PFC Moss has intentionally tried to mislead the panel, because it's made in the first person, it's unreasonable to believe that the panel didn't give it some weight.
Okay. I'm still back in wondering whether this is IAC at all, wondering whether this fell below the admittedly rather minimal Strickland standard. Here you are, your defense counsel. You have talked about what you're going to put on with the client. The client has insisted that this go in as an unsworn statement. That you've negotiated a PTA, a rather favorable PTA given the circumstances. And now here you are, and poof, she's gone. What are you supposed to do? She wanted this in.
She did want it in, according to the affidavit.
Yeah, the only question was she going to deliver it, or was counsel going to deliver it? It appears that the fact that she wanted it in is a given. The only question is who's going to mouth the words. So given those circumstances, how is this even IAC?
It's IAC because even though she wanted it in, the defense counsel advised her, this should not be the focal point of your unsworn statement because it's going to be uncooperated and it can be challenged by the government.
Right, and she said, I want it in. He can tell her anything she wants, and if she won't listen, she's the client.
But then it's a personal choice of the accused.
Well, it appears to have been a personal choice of the accused, doesn't it?
Well,
the fact that the accused vanishes like a character in Baroque opera doesn't change the fact that she made that choice. And she, the way I read the record, it appears that she insisted on this going in an unsworn statement, and the only question was who was going to say the words. So how is this even IAC?
And that's where this court's analysis in Markham comes into play. Now, Markham specifically looked at confidential information being released. However, it also looked at court also looked at the tone of the substance, the tone coming out of the letter, and acknowledged that even most of the information had already been given to the panel by the accused on merits. This court looked at the graphic language, the tone, and that's where it becomes, if PFC Moss makes the statement against her counsel's advice, then that's on her, and she can control how that flows. And if she has the ability, if necessary, to then offer her rebuttal to the government's rebuttal.
Where does Markham say that this can't be an implied authorization? It obviously says that it is the client's decision, but where does it say that it has to be a specific authorization and it can't be an implied authorization?
Markham states if an accused is absent without leave, his right to make an unsworn statement is forfeited unless prior to his absence he authorizes his client to make a specific statement on his behalf.
Isn't that what happened here?
No, we don't know for sure that that's the case. We have PFC Moss. She could have made the statement on her own, and then if she chose to go through with it, then that was on her. She could have offered her rebuttal if she had made the statement. The defense counsel is the one that made the name, put the name Viola Mitchell.
Well, we got a woulda, coulda, shoulda. I'm back to defense counsel arguing with his client saying, you really shouldn't do this. And she said, I want this in. I want Aunt Viola in here. And the only question is, I don't know whether I want to say it or I want you to say it for me. Well, I can't say it because I've disappeared. So what's conscientious counsel supposed to do to carry out the wishes of his client when she's disappeared? The only person left to mouth the words is conscientious counsel.
What about Aunt Viola?
Who talked
to Aunt Viola?
No one.
Was defense counsel responsible for talking to Aunt Viola before either advising the client with respect to that statement or putting the statement on himself?
It would have been very helpful for him to have talked to her or else have someone able to address her situation. And defense counsel understood before he made the statement that no one was going to be able to corroborate who Aunt Viola was.
Didn't answer that. It didn't defense counsel track down Aunt Viola and found out that such a person did exist?
Yes, Your Honor.
But she was in no shape to do anything. And then the mysterious intermediary suddenly clammed up?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
However, that none of that information is before the panel. And then at that point, it either goes on the military judge or the defense counsel to ask for the, once the government makes the rebuttal evidence and then argues that she made up a story, at that point, either defense counsel or the military judge have to act.
Even before that, if the defense counsel determines that Aunt Viola exists and there are problems with the story, is defense counsel professionally obligated to take that into account before, on his own motion, offering a statement that the defense counsel can't make under Markham in this case? Didn't the defense counsel have the option of calling Aunt Viola as a witness or making a professional determination as to whether he could make a statement on behalf of the client about matters that he never discussed with his client, that is, the problems with Aunt Viola?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why it's unreasonable to offer that evidence that was so easily rebutted. He knew going in that he was going to have, this was going to be an issue, and the government was ready to pounce on it and offer the rebuttal that Aunt Viola does not exist, or at least her father has no idea who Aunt Viola is. And so at that point, he needs to make the decision to either cut bait or continue on that line.
Is there any evidence in the record that any of those thoughts went through defense counsel's head, either at the time or in the statement that he gave in this case?
Yeah, I see that my time has expired. I would like to answer your question, Your Honor. The defense counsel in his affidavit does note that he considered what to do, and he made the decision to go ahead and offer the extenuation mitigation. He found he, in his opinion, it was going to be strong mitigation. Now, he does say afterwards that had he known about Markham, he would not have made the statement.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you, counsel, for the appellant. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, Judges of the Court, and please the Court. I'm Captain Shomsky, and along with Major Elizabeth Claus, who represents the government in this matter. Appellant's claims fail because she has not shown any prejudice.
It's a little hard to hear you. Can you hear in the back? No. Yeah.
Sorry.
Or yell or do something. But
yes, sir.
Okay. Can you hear in the back? Well, look,
no,
we don't know yet. Say
not.
Something.
That's,
yeah.
I hope they can hear me now.
Okay.
That's good.
Right. Raise your hands in the back if for some reason you don't hear as the argument goes on, please. Carry on.
Appellant's claims fail because she's unable to show prejudice as a result of her defense counsel making an unsworn statement on her behalf in her desertion trial while she absented herself from. Specifically, turning to the ineffective assistance of counsel, while the defense counsel claims there's an error and the military judge agrees that there's an error, They fail to show that this is actually a deficiency under the Strickland analysis. Not all errors are equal. And in this case, the error did not deprive the appellant of her right to counsel. In fact, the defense counsel made a concerted effort to track down her story.
Just to be clear, are you saying, because one and two, sometimes if someone says Strickland, you don't know if they're talking one or two. Are you talking both, or are you talking two?
I'm talking one first, Your Honor.
So you don't think, in the government's view, there was no error on one?
No, I believe there was an error. I just don't believe that error rises to the level of deficiency.
Oh, okay.
And I believe that the deficiency...
Deficiency under prong one or deficiency when contemplated with prong two?
In conjunction, I suppose, Your Honor. But specifically, I believe that we can win on either prong. The stronger argument is that there's simply no prejudice in this case. That the defense counsel argued exactly what his client wanted him to argue. That he has an uncontested affidavit in this case. That it was her intent to make this the thrust of her sentencing argument. Even when she was advised... that they were certainly going to have a problem with proof, that Ms. Viola Mitchell was going to be difficult to come by. The defense counsel made a concerted effort to track down witnesses. He knew that the father of the appellant was going to be there. In fact, the appellant requested that the trial be delayed so that the father could testify on her behalf.
Did defense counsel know that the father was going to say that Aunt Viola either doesn't exist or he has no relationship to the accused?
Yes, Your Honor, he did know that. Specifically in his handwritten notes that he attaches to the affidavit, as ordered by the Army Court of Criminal Appeals, he specifically states that the father did not know who Ms. Viola was, or Ms. Mitchell was.
And did he know that at the time that he had his interaction with the client as to whether the statement would be made?
I can double-check the dates on it, Your Honor, but I assume as the handwritten notes were while preparing the case, before the witnessing, requesting witnesses, and the presumption is that he did.
See, it's not clear to me that he had that discussion with the client, that your father's going to testify and eviscerate your statement. Is there anywhere in the record that he advised the client, at the time the client was insisting that this information go forth, that your father is going to rebut it and eviscerate your statement?
He does talk about the serious advantages and disadvantages of presenting that evidence, Your Honor, specifically in Joint Appendix 133.
I understand that.
Whether he specifically addresses the father's rebuttal, that's unclear.
And isn't that the fulcrum of the issue on ineffective assistance of counsel, that he presented evidence in this case that was subject to complete and unrebutted rebuttal, and that he did not, at least on this record, discuss with his client that was what was going to happen?
To point it in a different way, the client clearly knew this. If the father didn't know who Ms. Mitchell was, she was the recipient. She knew that knowledge.
How did she know what the father was going to testify to in this case? Where in the record does it say that she knew that the father was going to contradict her testimony?
Well, it's not explicit, Your Honor.
How do we know that that the father's recollection is different from hers? And that in her recollection, she had a relationship with this Viola and her father was aware of it. How do we know one way or another?
Well, I don't believe anywhere in the record it also says that the father was aware of it. In fact,
I understand that. But the question is what she knew at the time that she was having her conversation with her attorney as to whether the statement should go forward. Where in the record does it show that she knew that the father was going to testify that her statement was untrue or otherwise undermine her statement, and that she nonetheless, knowing that, decided that she was going to insist that the testimony be given?
So the record's not clear.
Okay, thank you.
However, the defense counsel relied on his appellant's version of the events. And not only on her version of events, but he relied on his own independent investigation. When he spoke to the intermediary, when he found out that Ms. Mitchell existed, when he spoke to the defense, the father of the appellant, and realized that he knew that what she was going to say, he made an educated choice to go forward. Now, in hindsight, being is what it is, he decided that he would not have made that call.
Now, are you making the case that what he said was precisely what she would have said and precisely what she said during the preparation?
I'm making the... there's no evidence that it was word for word what she would have said, Your Honor. What it is clear is that he took the language from her sworn testimony that would not be rebutted by her prior sworn statements to her commanders, so that he could make a sworn statement without inference.
So he was as clear as she had been in their pre-briefs that aunt was an honorific, for example, and not necessarily a biological aunt.
He does not clarify that point.
He does not clarify that. So there is a difference between the preparatory material and what was actually said by the counsel.
The client wasn't as clear either. So I may have missed...
But if the client had been there, then she would have been in a position to say, not really my aunt, but someone I call my aunt.
Yes, Your Honor. She would have been able to make that position if she was there. However, the defense counsel was able to undercut any rebuttal evidence by saying, hey, isn't it true that people that we are not related to are often called aunts? Yes, it is. Isn't it true that you weren't where she was for the past 3 years before she was apprehended? So he made all those steps in order to limit any impeachment value of the rebuttal evidence.
Now, you're sort of arguing in the alternative. You focused on prong one.
Yes,
I think I heard you say earlier prong two is the better of the two arguments or the stronger.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you believe that. And so might you just say why prong two is so effective?
Prong two is very effective in the stance that this is exactly what the client wanted to do, and this is the thrust of what she felt was her extenuation. He had warned her of the threats, and he wanted to put forth a story that while she was gone, what she was doing. She wasn't simply gallivanting across the land. This is not what she wanted to do. This is what she presented to her command prior to going to trial. The appellant's defense counsel simply put that forth in front of the panel. And he did so, and he had a couple of options while he was in sentencing in this very difficult situation. He could have given the unsworn statement as he did. He could have tried to relax the rules of evidence and submit the sworn testimony as sworn statements that she gave to her command. Or he could have done nothing regarding this information.
Could he have obtained a stipulation of fact?
A stipulation of fact would have had to be signed by the appellant, Your Honor.
In the absence of the appellant, is a stipulation of fact precluded in a court martial where the appellant is absent without authority?
Unfortunately, I don't know that answer.
Okay. Let's assume that it isn't.
If the
attorney can make a statement as if it were coming from the mouth of the accused, why would an attorney be precluded from presenting a stipulation of fact?
An unsworn statement is different from a sworn stipulation of fact on many regards. Unsworn statements are not subject to perjury charges. Statements of fact are uncontroverted truths. While it's possible, it wasn't addressed in this case, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the defense counsel did his very best while put in a very tough situation to get the mitigation and extenuation that the appellant wanted to the panel.
Was the attorney precluded from calling Aunt Viola?
The attorney was unable to call Viola because of her mental and physical status and the inability to find her. The U.S. Marshals went out looking for her and were unable to actually come down with a human person. They weren't able to find her.
You started talking about prejudice and then you sort of got off the track. Would you get back on prejudice?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In this case, the appellant faced 1 year of confinement and a bad conduct discharge for a 3-year AWOL that was ended by apprehension. And ended while the... The defense counsel negotiated a deal for 6 months, and the panel sentenced her to exactly those 6 months. The appellant suffered no prejudice in this case. Any damage that was done by the impeachment by her father was absolutely limited by their own glowing testimony that she could be rehabilitated by her father. The good soldier evidence that he also put on. The appellant now wishes, apparently, for the defense counsel to be held to this perfect attorney standard, to present only what would work instead of presenting exactly what she wanted to present. In this case, she got a sentence that matched the deal that she agreed to before going AWOL.
So did she agree that that would be the sentence in the case, or did she agree that that would be the maximum in the case?
The maximum, Your Honor.
Okay. And in this case, if this case had gone to a general court martial, what would have been the maximum? More than a year.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely.
So we have a case in which the government has agreed that the maximum going into the trial would be a year, and which the government has then entered into an agreement for how many months?
6 months, Your Honor.
Okay, so entered an agreement for 6 months. In that circumstance, why isn't a sentence of 6 months prejudicial if the government thinks this case is not worth the general court-martial and the government is willing to make a deal, convening authority is willing to make a deal for 6 months? Why isn't that prejudicial if that's what it ends up? Isn't that an indication that, notwithstanding the seriousness of the face of the charges, that this is a case in which a fairly low sentence was a predictable outcome?
Well, that was the time at which she was present to be part of this process.
Yeah.
But when the defense counsel was defending an empty chair, the government thought it was worth 9 months. And as such, they came under the mark because of the defense counsel's zealous advocacy for his client throughout the trial, including into clemency matters.
I understand all that, but there's some consideration in the government's case about how serious these offenses were. That's an important part of your prejudice argument. And my question is, hasn't the government already conceded that? Not you, but the manner in which the government prosecuted this case.
No, Your Honor. Specifically, when somebody is pleading guilty, obviously that lowers the threshold. They get mitigation for that. They get credit for that. And in this case, that's what she was getting. Also, it could have been taken into account that she had good soldiering ability and rehabilitative potential since she had been apprehended. So, in this instance, no, the government does not concede that this was a low threshold matter. When you miss 3 years of service, that's ended by an apprehension, and you miss a deployment because of it, that is a serious offense.
Could have gone to a general court-martial.
Could have gone.
Yeah.
But it didn't.
It did not. In this case, it went to a special court-martial, and she received only half of the maximum punishment. With the bad conduct discharge as well. And specifically, if we can move the military judge in this case, he did not create plain error. The appellant fails on both plain error and abuse of discretion because, again, he cannot show any prejudice. There's no likelihood that the sentence would have been less had the sentence not been given, had this unsworn not been given. Specifically, all of the live members in the court found that there was no prejudice to appellant. The defense counsel, prosecution, and the judge all agreed on the record that there was no prejudice to appellant. And as such, this court should give great deference then. They saw the testimony live. They were able to see the testimony in the body language of the father of the appellant and realized that his testimony saying, I don't know Miss Viola or Miss Mitchell, did not outweigh the benefits of his good soldier or her good soldier abilities and rehabilitative potential. And as such, the military judge was clear within his abuse of discretion when he found there was no prejudice. And he did not make any plain error.
I'm not sure why that's a zero-sum game. That is, in terms of the father's testimony. It may well be that the father's testimony was very helpful to the defense and helped bring the sentence down from the 9 months asked for by the government to the 6 months adjudged. How do we know that that's all that would have happened had the father not testified in rebuttal to the unsworn statement?
Because, again, the unsworn statement, while he says that he doesn't know, he doesn't specifically say that Ms. Mitchell does not exist. That's not what his testimony is. His testimony is that he doesn't know who this woman is. And he also testified that she had a problem, she had difficulties in her home growing up. And he also testifies that that he hasn't had contact with her since she went absent without leave in 2006. So there's a lot of things that can happen in this young lady's life in 3 years, including finding someone that she cares about.
And did the government accept that in making its argument on sentencing, that there could be truth to the statement made by in the unsworn statement, or did the government seek to exploit the unsworn statement in that regard?
Yeah, they do say that she made up the story, and that can be taken as a full fabrication, or it could be taken as they mitigated or exaggerated the result. But at the end of the day, the government does concede that not everybody we know, your father wouldn't know everybody that you would call it on, and it's not as prejudicial as the appellant would like to make it today, has she been present. But again, this case rises and falls on the actual prejudice to appellant. The defense counsel did everything in his power to give her a fair shot, to be the gladiator in her case that's required by Strickland. And as such, there was no prejudice that resulted from his actions. And this court should find that there was no prejudice and that each of the appellant's claims failed. I'm here for the questions.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, is there a rebuttal?
Regarding the statements that PFC Moss made to her command when she came back from the absence, she never stated Violet Mitchell's names. The only thing that she said was that she was taking care of a sick aunt. So even if those statements had come in, if the defense had offered those statements to come in under relaxed rules, the name Violet Mitchell would not have been there. So therefore, the government would have had nothing to cross-examine or offer her father's rebuttal for. And once the rebuttal was made, with her being absent, the defense counsel had nothing that he could then offer rebuttal for. And that gets back to whether it was reasonable for him to even make this statement, knowing that it could be so easily rebutted. If she had made the statement, as it was her intent to do, then certainly she had that ability. But the conversation was never had that she was not going to be present for trial and the ramifications of what would happen if the statement was made in her absence and then the follow-on rebuttal and the inability to offer sir rebuttal. So it was unreasonable to make that choice.
What are the obligations of a defense counsel when his client disappears? Obviously, the representation isn't terminated. Obviously, he has a continuing duty to represent her zealously within the bounds of the law. But what exactly are his obligations?
He has to continue representing her, Your Honor. And he has to.
Does that mean he just sits there mum, or what does it mean? It's an odd situation, which one hopes doesn't happen very often. But
it's not a position that anybody would want to be in. But that doesn't mean that you cannot, that you throw reasonableness out the window and then don't make the decisions and know the second and third order effects of what's going to happen stemming from your actions. As this court said in Boone, counsel can mishandle evidence to the point where it becomes either useless or almost useless. In this case,
well, of course, we're talking about an unsworn statement, which isn't evidence.
Of course, Your Honor.
Counsel, to ask the question that I asked government counsel, in a case in which the accused is absent without authority, may the defense counsel enter into a stipulation of fact as part of the defense counsel's responsibilities in the case, if a stipulation of fact would be in the interest of his or her client?
My initial response would be that no, it cannot be done because the military judge has to have this colloquy with the accused about the effects of a stipulation.
I understand. My question, is there any case law about what can be done in those circumstances if the only way to present evidence favorable to the defense would be through a stipulation of fact? Would the law preclude the defense from entering into that stipulation when the client is absent?
I've not had the opportunity to research that, Your Honor.
What about a stipulation?
You want us to add that to your list?
That's not a request on my part.
Yeah. What about a stipulation of the accused's expected testimony?
That would seem to probably not be supported. There is an argument to be made that a stipulation of fact, since it's between the government and the defense, as long as the information is not harmful and it doesn't offer, and then the government cannot rebut it, then it would be an analysis of what's the error. But the stipulation of expected testimony from the accused is it's their right to make the decision whether they're going to testify at a trial.
Never mind.
The government made some arguments about prejudice. Do you care to rebut any of those arguments? And do you care to tell us what effect, if any, and even whether we should consider the fact that there is a PTA for 6 months? Two separate questions.
Yes, Your Honor. First, regarding the prejudice question, the prejudice is clear because the panel did consider this information. They asked follow-up questions. And then the government was able to argue it successfully. And on defense counsel's argument, he continued with the same line. He doubled down and said, PFC Moss took care, went home to take care of a beloved Ann Viola, referenced the Ann three more times. The prejudice, there's no way that the panel did not consider this. And then when we look at what the PTA is, it's 6 months. That is a cap of what Private First Class Moss was willing to deal for. Doesn't mean that she would have not tried to put on a extenuation of mitigation case and try to get 3 months or 2 months or anything below that. It's just merely a cap. And the government thought that that was a fair price for this case and agreed to it. And it has no bearing as far as whether that's the right sentence in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions? All right. The court thanks both counsel. The case is submitted, and we will specify whatever questions we are going to specify, and you will have 1 week from the date upon receipt of those. So don't worry if they do not magically appear today. The clock isn't running till you get them. And then you'll have a week from the date of receipt of any response. Fair enough? All right. The court stands in recess until further order of the court.
All rise. Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.